This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
On WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York City. So please do stay tuned for what is coming up next, which should be this.
Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
My babe was talking, and what she said is true. It seems like time's getting tough, like it was in 32. You don't have no job, our bills is past due. So now tell me, baby, what are we gonna do? Tough time. Tough time is here once more. If you don't have no money, people, you can't live happy no more. I had a good job, working many long hours a week. They had a big layoff, and they got poor me. I'm broken, disgusted, in misery. Can't find a part-time job. Nothing in my house to eat. Tough time. Tough time is here once more. Went down to the grocery store, said I'd get a little more food on time. That man said, wait a minute, see how do we stand? Say, I'm sorry to tell you, you do fall behind. Tough time. Tough time is here once more. No money, can't live happy no more.
And welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City with me, Bill Weinberg. And we were opening up there with Chicago bluesman John Brim and his Tough Time Boys with his signature song, Tough Times, recorded back in 1952, apparently about the economic downturn of 1950. People tend to think of the 1950s as a time of unbridled prosperity, but apparently there was a sort of a big post-war recession of 1949 to 50. You know about this, Andrew?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Before my time.
Right. Mine too. But, well, recorded for posterity by John Brim back in 1952. So, things weren't entirely what they seemed back in the glorious 50s that we're all supposed to be so nostalgic for. And unfortunately, that song might be, all too timely for 2008. And we're joined tonight by Andrew Kleinman, who is the author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency, which is hot off the press from Lexington Books in Lanham, Maryland. And you gave a presentation exactly a week ago at the New Space, the new school for pluralistic anti-capitalist education, entitled A Marxist Analysis of the Economic Crisis, Worse Than They Want You to Think, a very cheerful title. So is it, in fact, worse than they want us to think? What do you mean by that, for starters, Andrew?
Well, thanks for having me here, first of all, Bill. Worse than they want you to think, who's the they that
right.
I'm referring to?
Who's the they, precisely, the
right.
first question.
You know, Bernanke, Paulson, they think it's bad. They want us to think it's bad. What I was referring to when I said they is a lot of the liberals and a lot of the left who, at the time of the proposal of the bailout and when it was coming before Congress and there was a massive furor, they were saying that the bailout wasn't needed. It was just a massive giveaway to the rich. You know, even there wasn't any real crisis, no immediacy that had to be addressed at that point. So people were on the left, liberals, oftentimes downplaying the severity of the crisis, downplaying the immediacy and the acuteness of the crisis that was faced at that time, proposing various kinds of policies which might be good in and of themselves, like infrastructure investment, rebuilding cities, helping foreclosed homeowners, but none of them dealt with the immediate acute crisis of confidence that we were facing at that time and that to a large degree still exists. So both by not addressing the immediacy of that crisis of confidence in the financial markets and by portraying the bailout package as just a giveaway, a lot of the liberals and the left were making us think that the crisis was a lot less severe, less critical than I think it was and than the financial market seems to think it is.
So, ironically, the they that you're referring to is our supposed allies on the left.
That's exactly right.
Uh-huh. Who were sort of leading us into a false sense of security.
Yes. Not intentionally, but it goes along with the desire to make the issue one of income redistribution. You know, who's going to be helped? Is it going to be the rich? Is it going to be people who invest and lend? You know, in the financial markets, or is it going to be foreclosed homeowners and people facing layoffs and so forth and so on? And
well, that's certainly a legitimate question.
It certainly is a legitimate question, but it's not quite relevant, I believe, to the purpose of that bailout. The bailout was not an income redistribution or a wealth redistribution measure. It was meant primarily to overcome the very severe panic, the crisis of confidence. When they say confidence in the financial markets, it's not some generalized confidence. It's confidence particularly of lenders that when they lend, they're going to get the money that's owed them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very concrete, immediate thing. And also the confidence of owners that their investment is not going to go away. So that is the panic that's been exhibited in the financial markets increasingly, and it became very acute in September.
Okay, so the bailout was not, quote-unquote, socialism for the rich, in your view?
Well, I think it is socialism for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose was not to make the rich richer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if by socialism you mean state ownership, it's not what I mean by socialism, but that's what a lot of people seem to mean. There is clearly now state ownership. The U.S. government took over AIG, one of the huge insurance firms. It explicitly took over the big mortgage lenders, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. It's taking over partial ownership of a lot of the big banks and investment banks. So that's going on. I mean, also a tremendous amount of regulation is going to accompany that. They are helping the lenders recover the monies that are owed to them. Their concern is not to protect the investments of the owners. You have to make a distinction between the lenders and the owners. Nothing that the government has done has really been to protect the owners. They are trying to protect the lenders because if the lenders panic that they are not going to get the funds that are owed to them, they're going to stop lending to a very large degree. They've stopped. And when that happens, the whole capitalist economy is fueled by lending,
mm-hmm.
even just to get from today to tomorrow, to buy your supplies in order to produce, to hire your workers in order to produce. Lots of very big firms rely on short-term lending. So, yes, the government wants to quell that fear, quell the crisis of confidence. So, yes, they are protecting the monies that are owed to the lenders in order to keep the system afloat, in order to try to save the capitalist system. So it's not that the purpose is, oh, we just want to redistribute income and wealth to the rich, make the rich richer. But to save the system, you have to make sure that the lending continues to flow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we should say that you're qualified to speak on these matters. You're a professor of economics at Pace University. And so your basic thesis, and much of what you said last week actually went over my head, which is why I wanted to get you on the radio to speak about it in greater detail and allow me the opportunity to interject questions. But your basic thesis was that this bailout is actually, the point is not even to bail out Bush's Wall Street friends, but to shore up capitalism, and that there actually is a real fundamental crisis of the system that we're looking at.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the crisis has several manifestations. The most immediate and acute one that was exhibited in particular last month, but that had been building, is just the generalized fear throughout the financial markets that has led to a drying up of credit far greater, far more serious and disturbing to the whole system than what is normally seen in a recession. In a recession, people talk about a credit crunch. That's certainly what was happening, but to a much greater degree. An official at the Boston Fed called this a liquidity lock. Liquidity is basically cash. So there was just the inability of even big firms, well-established firms, to borrow for more than overnight. But that's how they get by from day to day, just to do business. This is not a matter of investing to expand your, build new factories, build new office space or anything. This is just a matter of buying supplies, hiring workers, paying your bills, and so forth and so on.
All right. So what brought this about, this a level of crisis this profound? What led up to this? When a lot of people have been kind of taken by surprise here. We've been told for the past generation and more since the Reagan Revolution that you let the magic of the market take care of everything. There's nothing to worry about. There can never be another depression like we saw in the 30s. So
Where did this come from? Why is this happening now?
Right. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that free market ideology. First of all, because in the past several days, Alan Greenspan, former head of the Fed, basically said, oh, well, you know, we were wrong about that. It was a very...
flaws in our ideology, I believe, is what he admitted to.
Right. Yeah. And you really have to understand the depth to which people like Greenspan believe this. Greenspan has long been a devotee of Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. You know, Atlas Shrugged and all of that. And when he spoke of his prior belief that the markets would regulate themselves, this is not because Greenspan was naive. It's not because he didn't know. He knew very well that, you know, firms are greedy and that they will try to hoodwink the other side. But the idea was always that, well, the other side wants to protect itself as well, and it's going to try to get the information it needs about how safe the investments are that it's making, how safe the loans are that it's making, and that the markets would, in the end, provide this information through the competitive process. And basically what he, in fact, said is the markets don't regulate themselves to the degree necessary. Basically, the system does not work, is what he said. Now, he still came out and said, well, I would rather have the markets do it rather than anything else I've seen. But to address the underlying question you were asking, where did this all start? How far back would you like me to go?
As far back as you want.
Okay. Well, it's my view that what I do remember, because I was around then, was the global economic crisis of the mid-1970s, brought on by the first OPEC oil shock. I believe it was October of 73.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to a very long recession. Then there was a, you know, bout of inflation, along with stagnation, became known as stagflation. It's my view that the world economy has never fully recovered from that downturn. There's been a partial recovery, but that did not lead to a new boom in the manner in which the Great Depression and then World War II, after all of that destruction, there were conditions for a new post-war boom, tremendous prosperity for, you know, even a great many working class people in America and the other advanced countries. I mean, Japan became industrialized, a tremendous power. Germany rebuilt itself, became a world power. That was the post-war boom from pretty much the end of World War II till about 1973. What came out of the period after the mid-70s is nothing like that. There's been a partial recovery.
Well, we have seen at least two booms, right? There was the Reagan boom, which ended in 1987. And then there was the, you know, the Clinton boom or the dot-com boom, which ended, I guess, around 99 or 2000.
That's correct.
Right.
They have not been, though, fundamentally sustainable because, as we see with the dot-com boom, it was really financed by a bubble. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of money being pumped into the system, artificially driving up stock prices and so forth. That was not a sustainable situation. We just did not have a boom in the manner which...
What's the difference, if I may interject the question, between a bubble and a real or sustainable boom?
You only know that afterward,
mm-hmm.
When the bubble bursts.
Okay. But what's the definition of a bubble?
Okay. A bubble is a rise in the prices of some assets like stocks or homes or wherever it might be. There was the tulip bubble way, way back when in
right.
Amsterdam when the prices of tulips just kept going.
In the 17th century, I believe? Or?
Yeah, sometime yeah. before my time.
Yes.
Way, way, way back.
Yes.
17th century, maybe 18th century, 16th yeah. century. So the asset prices go up. But what does it mean that they go up? They go up over and above the fundamentals. Now, depending on who you ask, you'll get a different view of what the fundamentals are. But my understanding of fundamentals as somebody who studied Marx and thinks that what he says is relevant is that the real fundamental is the production of value. Okay. So if the prices are rising faster than the underlying flow of value, that is really not sustainable. Let me give you an example with the most recent crisis. I think it's pretty well known that it got started as a crisis in the housing sector.
Yes.
And that is a result of a huge run-up of home prices from about the beginning of the decade through home prices peaked about the middle of 2006. Okay. They just shot up from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2005. Home prices doubled in this country, according to the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. But what is this worth? Okay. Was what the home is worth, but fundamentally what's going on is to buy homes, people are borrowing. They're taking out mortgages. Okay. So you have to ask, what is the mortgage worth to the lender? What the mortgage is worth to the lender is the flow of mortgage payments that are going to be coming in throughout time. If it's a 30-year loan, the payments are going to be coming in for 30 years. So what is supporting that is a flow of income.
Mm-hmm.
And that income is coming from the production of new value. So there's got to be a flow of value sufficient to make those payments, okay? Or otherwise that loan is, you know, too much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When you say production of new value, you're actually talking about factories churning out products which people are going to consume.
Products, services as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. And when this translates into somebody's paycheck that he takes home when puts in the bank and writes off a check once a month to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, that's
right.
Part of it, right?
Mm-hmm. That clogged up. That ceased to work, obviously.
What is that?
Well, people weren't paying their mortgages.
Right. People weren't paying their mortgages for a variety of reasons. One of the main reasons why they weren't paying their mortgages was that the mortgage rates were actually high or above what people could sustain on the basis just of their normal income, which is what's coming from the flow of value. But for a long time, that had worked because home prices had always kept rising. And so people who were getting into trouble on their mortgages, they would have some equity in their home. They would have paid off some of their mortgage, so what they owed was less than the value of their home, and they could borrow against the additional amount and use those borrowed funds to make additional mortgage payments.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as home prices kept going up...
And thereby get deeper into debt,
mm-hmm. It is kind of a Ponzi scheme, okay? And they got deeper into debt... but it would have worked if home prices had kept going up.
And why did they suddenly not go up?
Well, I can't say, you know, why suddenly, you know, why specifically this bubble burst in the middle of 2006. But if income is going up by 34% from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2005, and home prices are going up by triple that amount, it's just not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because what's keeping up the home prices is fundamentally the mortgage lending. And the mortgage lending is based on the belief, the confidence that you're going to be repaid these mortgages. And that depends on the flow of income. And that depends on a flow of value from new production. And a rise of 34% from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2005 is nothing to sneeze at, but it's nothing that can support a doubling of home prices during that period either.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it had to happen sooner or later.
Yeah, it had to happen sooner or later,
right.
Exactly.
Okay. So What is the relation between this, what we've just witnessed in the past 6 months, and or a little bit more than 6 months now, because really the bubble burst in February, right? What does this have to do with what happened in the 1970s?
Okay, right. Again, my thesis is that the economy of the world never fully recovered. And, however, for very clear reasons, policymakers, economic policymakers here and elsewhere, did not want a repeat of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they didn't want the world economy to collapse in the manner that it did in the Great Depression and then World War II. But the collapse is what really is the, trigger for a new boom. So instead of letting the system basically collapse and then regenerate itself through the destruction of value, and we can talk about that in a moment,
yes.
They've tried to paper over the crisis to ameliorate it. For instance, wages of workers, in this country have never fully recovered to their levels of 1972, 1973.
Adjusted for inflation.
Inflation. But what has been propping up the system artificially to a greater and greater extent is debt. More and more borrowing. Mm-hmm. Government borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
Corporate borrowing. Of course, the mortgage borrowing and also other consumer borrowing. Credit card borrowing, auto loans, and so forth. So, in the U.S. in particular, people have been living well beyond their means in terms of their actual income. And as long as you had stock prices going up, home prices going up, that didn't seem to be any particular problem because, well, you know, hey, you have capital gains of $20,000. It's just like income of $20,000. But when the stock prices have gone down the way they have, and the home prices have gone down the way they have, we're back to the fundamental income that's not coming from just an explosion of asset prices. And the incomes of Americans just can't support that. In the last 3 years, 2005, 2006, 2007, the personal saving of Americans is essentially nothing. Okay. Once you take away the rising asset prices that we had up to recently, basically Americans are saving nothing for their future.
Mm.
That's just not sustainable.
Okay. So, all right. After the 1970s, you had there was a pretty deep recession actually when Reagan first got in the early 80s, and then for some reason, which I'm not privy to, there was a boom after that, which had to do, certainly here in New York, had a lot to do with real estate. That went on through from, 84, 85 through 87, when the stock market crashed again. And then we had the Bush recession. And then we had another boom in the 90s after that. So, in what sense did, and what has been driving this cycle is my first question. My second question is, in what sense did the economy not fundamentally recover from the recession of the 70s, if in fact there were two booms in the intervening period? And what do you mean, if you can keep track of all three questions, what do you mean by destruction of value or destruction of capital giving rise to the new boom? How does that process work? What do you mean by that? And why did it not happen after the 1970s?
Okay. Can I address the last one first?
Sure.
Okay.
And they're all kind of interrelated, right?
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. The destruction of capital comes in two flavors. There's the physical destruction of capital, such as occurred in World War II through, you know, bombings of cities and so forth. There's also physical destruction when you have a serious recession or depression and factories lie idle and the machines rust. And you can include in that phenomena such as the old stories of the farmers who couldn't sell their pigs for meat because of spending being low in the Depression, and so they build big ditches and they push the pigs in there. That's all physical destruction of capital. But the biggest destruction of capital is a destruction of the value, a decline in the value of real assets like machinery and factory buildings and office space and so forth, but also financial capital, investments. So their prices decline in a downturn, in a recession, especially in a serious depression. That's what is the mechanism of the downturn, but it gives rise, if it's sufficient, to a new boom. For a very simple reason. You have a business, and let's say that the business generates $3 million profit annually. And the old owners invested $100 million in that business. So they're getting $3 million a year. They invested $100 million a year. Their rate of profit or rate of return is a measly 3%. Okay. But if sufficient destruction of capital has occurred, let's say destruction of value, the prices of the machines have gone down, the price of the factory has gone down, all of the financial assets can be acquired for much less. So let's say they're acquired not for $100 million, but for $10 million. Mm-hmm. Well, then if the business is still churning out a profit of $3 million a year and you're only paying $10 million for that business, that's not a rate of return of 3%. That's a rate of return, a rate of profit of 30%. That's a tremendous that's a tremendous incentive, tremendous spur to reinvest, and that will start off a new boom, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I think that's fairly well understood. Some implications of this are that, left to itself, absent a movement to do away with the system, the capitalist system can always recover from any crisis or any slump, depression, given enough destruction of capital in terms of the physical destruction and the destruction of value.
All right, well, can I just interject the question here? After I mentioned, by the way, that it's 12:31 in the morning, I'm listening to supported non-commercial WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City, and this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and I'm Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Andrew Kleiman, who is the author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency, and we will ask him later on what that title means. But meanwhile, this notion that capital needs to be destroyed in order to pave the way for the next boom. Is this standard economics, or is this strictly a Marxist interpretation? Would the Friedmanites agree, and would the Keynesians agree? And is how radical a notion is this?
I think it's fairly well known. It has not been stressed a lot, I would say, since the Keynesian Revolution in economics of the 1930s. It was not, I believe, a unusual notion back in Marx's day. I mean, he took a lot from what other people were writing, not just radicals, but mainstream economic thinkers. And even now, you have one sort of faction of the bourgeoisie, kind of the hard right faction. You will hear them, for instance, like on Channel 15. What's that? CNBC, the financial news.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people will just say, look, there should be no bailout. In fact, we should cheer the plummeting of the stock market. What this does is it wipes away all of the old stuff. It wipes away the failing businesses, and it clears the way for the winners.
Survival of the fittest.
Survival of the fittest. And in essence, this is the same notion, just expressed somewhat differently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's expressed in terms of the successful ones, the ones that can make it versus the ones that can't make it. But what's underlying this is, of course, the fact that the values fall, and the new owners can come in and buy the assets for a fraction of what the previous owners bought them for. That's the fundamental movement. And what is specifically Marxist about this is a particular notion of what is underlying the collapse of the values, and that is increasing productivity. Higher productivity causes commodities values to fall, and that tends to depress their prices. This was very important to Marx because it's expressing a fundamental contradiction of the system. The aim of capital is to expand. Self-expanding value is how Marx described capital. So accumulate, accumulate. That's Moses and the prophet. Expansion, expansion, expansion. So the motivating aim of the system is to grow, expand, but this growth leads to technological progress, and the technological progress leads to falling values. So that's an inherent contradiction.
And yet the price of everything is going up. I mean, at the moment, the price of oil happens to be falling, but it's been going up very, very dramatically recently, and the price of food is going up. And, I mean, the price of everything is just, you know, both, even adjusted for inflation, the price of everything is much higher. The price of rent, the price of coffee, books, food, everything is much, much higher than it was 10 years ago.
To some extent, that's true, and to some extent, that is policy-driven.
Mm-hmm.
In an attempt to stave off a real cleansing of the system, so to speak, a real destruction of capital, a real bust such as we saw in the Great Depression and into World War II, where there was more destruction, policymakers have continually tried to prop up rates of profit, rates of return, and one way of doing that is by pumping tremendous amounts of debt into the system. And the debt fuels spending, and the spending props up prices. And by keeping up prices, that props up the rate of returns. But the issue is this being propped up artificially?
Right.
Okay? Because, again, we have this issue of expansion over and above the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do the Keynesians also recognize this process? Does it fit into their formulas as well? Because, I mean, certainly in the Keynesian Revolution, this, you know, was right in the middle of this whole process of destruction of capital.
I'm not an expert on Keynes. I really can't answer this. I know, you know, I learned mainstream Keynesian economics because when I was studying economics, that was still, at least in the beginning when I was studying economics, that was still sort of the mainstream.
Right.
We never learned this notion.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you learned this notion from Marx?
Yeah, I got it from Marx.
And where is it in Marx?
Well, it's there in particular in Volume 3 of Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And in preparatory writings for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so during the Depression and the Second World War, an awful lot of value was destroyed, obviously, and this gave rise to the post-war boom. So then there was the oil shock in the 70s, which ground things to a halt a little bit. And is the reason that things haven't, in your view, fundamentally recovered, and there's sort of been these artificial booms which have been created through debt, if I've got that right, is the reason for that because not enough value was destroyed in the 70s? And there actually wasn't a depression, and there wasn't war on a massive scale?
Yeah, that's my view.
Okay.
That's my view. It's not the most optimistic outlook on capitalism, but yeah, in order to grow, the system has to contract.
Well, I mean, it struck me as very interesting that, you know, I mean, Bechtel built all the oil infrastructure in Iraq back in the 1950s and made a mint doing it, of course, and and then, what was that? I believe it was Shell and Exxon were the two biggest investors in Iraq in that period, and they made a mint selling the oil until it was nationalized in the late 60s, early 70s. And then Raytheon and Lockheed made a mint selling the arms to the Pentagon, which were used to destroy all that very same oil infrastructure, both in Desert Storm and Operation Iraqi Freedom. And now Bechtel is once again making a mint, rebuilding that same oil infrastructure. So that would seem to be a case in point of what you're talking about.
That's a very graphic illustration.
But yet it hasn't been sufficient to ward off a fundamental crisis.
No. Mm-hmm. No. It hasn't been sufficient enough to lead to a real boom that could be sustained without artificial injections of spending by means of debt.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the world economy has gotten from one crisis it's gotten out of one crisis into the next crisis continually for close to 30 years, beginning with the third world debt crisis.
All right, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Now, we heard a lot about that back in the 80s.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard so much about it recently, and yet I don't imagine that Brazil and India and Mexico are out of debt.
Right. I mean, some of these countries have effectively been allowed to renege on their debt because there's just no chance that they're going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries have had their debts rescheduled.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say what I'm not sure of, but I think I'm pretty sure that the U.S. government basically covered a lot of the debt, and the IMF covered a lot of the debt, the bad debt of the banks,
mm-hmm.
the third world loans that could not be repaid.
Right, both to private banks and to multilateral things like the IMF and the World Bank and so
right,
on. Right,
right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how did that contribute to the general crisis?
I wouldn't say it contributed to the crisis. I mean, they get out of the problem. Heretofore, they've gotten out of the problem of a debt crisis by means of more debt.
Mm-hmm.
And in its essence, it's like the issue with the mortgage borrowing we were talking about. People can't pay their mortgages, but they have equity in their homes. They can borrow against that,
right.
Go deeper into debt, and they can pay back the old debt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's just like, you know, you're maxed out on one credit card, so you take your other credit card,
right.
And you use that. This is fundamentally the mechanism by which they have limped along from crisis to crisis over the past 30 years or so.
All right. So back in the 80s, when you were hearing a lot about the third world debt crisis, the U.S. was also going deeply into hock in order to fund the Reagan arms buildup. And at that time, we were going into hock to mostly to Germany and Japan. And now, apparently, we're in hock to China. So what happened to our debt to Germany and Japan, and how did we get into debt to China?
First of all, let me say about the Reagan and the military buildup and military spending. That certainly took place, but keep in mind that Reagan cut a lot of government programs and a lot of federal government spending in other areas.
And yet the national debt went up astronomically.
Right. So why did it go up? It wasn't because of a huge increase in spending. The rate of increase in spending basically remained the same under Reagan as before.
Yeah.
What happened that was different was he came in, he says, I'm going to cut taxes,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you're spending at the same rate, but you're bringing in less in taxes, you've got to borrow the remainder.
The bloating of the Pentagon budget was not a significant card in this scenario?
It was offset by other reductions in spending, for various social programs and so forth and so on.
Hmm.
So the rate of spending basically remained the same. Reagan came in, though. He says, I'm going to cut taxes. He cut taxes tremendously. And that is fundamentally when the deficit started growing, the federal debt started growing at
a massive
rate.
So why did he do it?
Well, if you listen to David Stockman, who was Reagan's budget director,
right?
The reason that they cut taxes while keeping spending up was to essentially bankrupt the federal government. That's a loose term because you can't bankrupt the federal government. But it was essentially to have a massive explosion of the debt, which would make it so politically infeasible to have an activist government of the kind that we saw sort of in the 1960s that funded government programs and so forth. It would make it very difficult to have an interventionist or activist fiscal policy that would try to fine-tune the economy to get out of recessions and so forth.
Right,
now,
so
that's not what they said at the time.
Right.
What they said at the time is, we believe in supply-side policies, and you can cut tax rates, and because people are paying a smaller percentage of their profits in taxes, a smaller percentage of their income in taxes, that's going to fuel people to work so hard and businesses to invest so much that even though they're paying lower tax rates, they're producing so much that the overall tax revenue would go up.
Right.
What Stockman says is, we didn't believe that for a moment.
Wait, Stockman has admitted this now?
Yes, Stockman admitted that, I believe, while Reagan was still in office, when he was no longer budget director, but if not shortly after that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so this was entirely, in your view, an ideological program to actually cripple the ability of the federal government to engage in sort of Keynesian sort of programs?
It was that plus the difficulties that the Republicans had in getting elected.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people don't like a huge budget deficit and debt in theory, but they like lower taxes.
Right.
And the line against the tax and spend liberals, the tax and spend Democrats, succeeded. It's still being trotted out now by
McCain. Yeah.
And what people sort of did not grasp, surprisingly, regular people, is that instead of tax and spend, what the Republicans were going to give us is borrow and spend. That linkage between cutting taxes and funding the difference by borrowing was not terribly well understood.
Mm.
I mean, because people say, well, let's have lower taxes and bring down the debt. You know, well, if you look at the federal government spending, there is basically nothing that can be cut to.
All right. So what happened to the debt to Japan and Western Europe, which was jacked up during that period? And how did we wind up in hock to China now, 20 years later?
Well, the debt to those other countries is still there. I mean, the government keeps borrowing and borrowing more and more and more. So those other countries still hold a great deal of treasury paper.
Germany and Japan?
I believe so.
Yeah.
But to some degree, China has become an immense economic power since the Tiananmen massacre.
Yes.
They've bought a lot of this paper as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is your view of the bailout? Apart from an actual sort of objective analysis of what it was aimed to do, and that it wasn't really about bailing out the rich so much, it was about bailing out the capitalist system. Does that mean, in your view, that we should support it or not?
Well, I don't support it because I don't support the capitalist system. But I think that, you know, if you want to save the capitalist system, something like the bailout, something that does not differ except in detail from the kind of bailout that we're seeing, would have to have been instituted.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the tremendous crisis of confidence in the financial markets. And that is a crisis in the confidence that loans are going to be repaid to the lenders. If that situation had continued, and it's still largely there, but if it had continued with the degree of panic that we were seeing about a month ago, I don't know where we would be right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that anybody knows, but we could have seen a collapse of the system. They were just not, they're just not going to allow that to happen.
Right, exactly. So it was sort of inevitable that they were going to do what they did.
Yes, yeah. Either what they did or
something
that just
fundamentally similar.
Fundamentally similar. For instance, the original idea of the bailout was to buy up some of the bad debt of the banks,
mm-hmm.
the bad mortgage debt and mortgage-backed securities and all the rest of that. Now they're moving towards directly recapitalizing the banks. I mean, investing in the banks. The basic idea is the same. That's when I say differing just by details. It's something like that. They have to do this. Basically, since March, the U.S. government in particular has sent consistent signals that it will do whatever it needs to do to save the system. You know, it will eliminate every free market principle that there is, because, you know, ideology is one thing, but their system is another thing.
Yes.
So when they forced Bear Stearns to be sold off to J.P. Morgan Chase, that's a tremendous violation of free market principles. It was not helping the owners of Bear Stearns at all. They took a huge hit. They were really angry. Because of things like that, I just don't understand why anybody thinks that the government is out to, you know, redistribute wealth and redistribute income to the rich. They didn't have at all the interest of Bear Stearns owners in mind. What they're trying to do is save the system, and what they were showing was, what we're going to do is whatever it needs to keep the system afloat. For a long time, the doctrine had been that some of the major commercial banks were too big to fail.
Mm-hmm.
That had not been extended to Wall Street firms, investment banks. But basically they were saying, Bear Stearns is too big to fail. We won't let it fail. We mm-hmm. won't let it go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If Bear Stearns had gone bankrupt, a lot of the stockholder value would have been protected. Mm-hmm. At the time when Bear Stearns was taken over, shares of the firm were selling at about $30 in the market, and the Fed came in and tried to get J.P. Morgan Chase to be able to buy that up at $2 a share, $2 a share instead of $30. That's about 7%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was so much uproar that the eventual price was somewhere around $10 a share.
Mm-hmm.
But that's still one-third of what the stock was selling for on the open market mm-hmm. Immediately before.
So a lot of people lost a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So now, I mean, the two big winners here seem to have been J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. And, you know, now they're really too big to fail, I guess. I mean, they seem to control almost all of the major financial institutions in the country, with a few exceptions.
And Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has now become a bank holding company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an investment bank that holds commercial banks that take customers' deposits and make business loans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of federal government money which has been involved in this reshuffling. So you've termed it state capitalism.
Right. To some extent, the term state capitalism refers to a system where you have state ownership and government planning, so to speak, although no capitalist system, even if it's state controlled, so to speak, is ever really planned, because they're always subject to crises and they're just engaged in mopping up operations that they call planning. But Raya Dunevskaya used the term state capitalism also more broadly. She used it in that sense of state planning and state ownership.
All right, the examples, I suppose, being Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, then China, mm-hmm. and Eastern Bloc countries and so forth, the ex-Eastern Bloc countries. But she looked more broadly at the tendency toward permanent government intervention into the economy that was ushered in with the New Deal of the 30s and other similar schemes in other countries, arguing that basically the system was in such a permanent state of crisis that the government needed continually to intervene. And so there was a tendency towards intervention, also a tendency towards statification that has sort of been there persistently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so perhaps we're at a real sort of fundamental turning point. I mean, in 1932, there was a big, with the election of that year, there was a big turning point towards state intervention, obviously, and that sort of set in place a framework or paradigm which lasted right on through until 1980 and the Reagan Revolution, and then it was overturned. And since then, you know, it's been the free trade, neoliberal, let the pigs run wild dogma, which has been in place, And now, in another election year, it seems to be tilting back towards a state capitalist model once again, very rapidly.
To some extent. However, and I wrote an analysis of this many, many years ago, and it's out there on the web. It's called New Forms of Appearance of State Capitalism. And I wrote this at the time kind of the collapse of the USSR and people saying that there'd been a fundamental decline in the economic role of the state. And certainly Keynesian kind of interventions, trying to smooth out the business cycle and such things as the social safety net, those kinds of government involvement went on the wane.
Definitely.
But there was another kind of government intervention that we were seeing at this time, for instance, the early 90s and thereafter. If you look at the restructuring of all kinds of economies in a so-called free market direction, who was doing the restructuring?
Well, governments, of course.
Governments, of course, and international financial institutions,
right,
like the World Bank and the IMF that are basically –
which are made up of governments. Which are made up of governments,
which are made up of governments, right, largely, right, you know, the one in this country. Mm-hmm. So this is a lot of government intervention. In Capital, again, the book Capital, Marx says when the system is just starting out, it needs the economic role of the state kind of to stabilize the entire situation. So you had laws against vagrancy, laws against the poor, forcing people to work, you know, in the big farms that were being created, forcing people to work in the factories, and so forth. Later on, he says the system can more or less govern itself by the economic laws that have been created, except in exceptional circumstances. And in times of exceptional circumstances, then the power of the state is needed to intervene to reconfigure the system,
mm-hmm,
to hold it together again. And I think that that is what was happening at the time.
At which time?
The early 90s.
Right.
The early 90s, when a lot of these countries were moving in a so-called free market direction.
Right. Well, that was away from government intervention. I mean, there's always plenty of government intervention, and particularly, I mean, there were the transition to a neoliberal stance occasioned a lot of social protest and uprisings, such as in Mexico most dramatically, and that, you know, necessitated government intervention in the form of military and police state type repression, which is a form of government intervention. But it's not what's seen as quote unquote government intervention in the economy.
Right, because people had a model on the left of government intervention as funding social programs and, you know, trying to prevent recessions and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But government intervention is just government intervention.
All right. So
government intervention took a particular cast in the 30s because of a huge social movement.
All right. So what was the cast in the 90s?
The cast in the 90s is that you know, in the third world in particular, these countries, if they could pay their debts at all, they were going to have to pay their debts. And so governments came in to restructure those economies, mm-hmm, to be debt repayment machines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you had the heavy hand of government, and this was admitted. You know, we need to go, I think it was the president of Brazil said, we need to go through the inferno of more government intervention, you know, more government control in order to have this free market.
Mm-hmm.
It seems paradoxical.
This was largely governments of the North through governments of the post-industrial North, particularly the United States, through the World Bank and the IMF, imposing measures on Brazil and Mexico and India, reining in the ability of their governments to manage the national economies.
Well, to some extent, however, what you had were those governments in those countries also doing it to the people in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it cannot just be looked at as, you know, the first world versus the third world.
Mm-hmm.
There are third world governments that are involved in this that are more than complicit, that are actively, you know, messing up the people of those countries to do that. Also, of course, what you had...
Right, but it was a surrender of what traditionally had been government power and government assets and government enterprises to private capital.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There was the selling off of assets.
Yeah.
Okay. But that you had the restructuring of these economies being undertaken fundamentally by the governments, all kinds of austerity measures being imposed by the governments.
Right.
This is government imposed austerity.
Mm-hmm.
This is not free market operation.
Well, all right, I don't want to get hung up on a semantic point, but they argued, you know, the ideologists of the free market argued that this is a free market because what, you know, we're calling austerity is actually governments living within their means and not giving people a handout, but making them work for a living. I mean, wasn't that the rhetoric which surrounded this?
Yes, but that's not necessarily a free market to make people work. Okay, so the free market is if the government stays out, if you have no regulations, and you just allow individuals to operate in their own self-interest,
as opposed to what actually happened, because that was certainly the rhetoric, right?
Right.
What was the reality?
Well, let me give you what I think is the really classic example here is what took place in Russia after the collapse of the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, in the beginning, some of these people really believed in the free market ideology.
Sure.
We just let markets work.
Right.
That led to complete chaos in Russia.
Yeah.
Okay. Then they realized that they had to listen to the other camp who said that markets fundamentally exist in a legal framework and they need the government there in order to work. So what they then began to do was to try to create certain legal structures and certain institutional structures, all by means of government involvement, that would then allow the markets to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to look at market and state, market and government intervention as opposites, is misleading at best. I think it's just an invalid notion. And
right.
I think we're seeing that it's invalid mm-hmm. right now.
Okay, but I mean, you saw the, Russia in some ways beat the U.S. to the punch in terms of reining in the excesses of the free market ideology and extending a greater amount of state control once again. I mean, Putin has been doing that for at least 5 years now, where, you know, the U.S. is just getting around to doing it now. And Putin was doing it over, you know, actual resources like oil, not just in the financial sector. But that was sort of at the other end of the process, right? That wasn't at the beginning of the process. What happened in Russia was definitely a contraction of state control of the economy, a radical contraction of state control in the economy. And it seems to me that something more or less analogous was also happening in the same period in Mexico, most of Latin America, where, you know, resources were just being privatized and the government was getting out of the business of running the economy, and the social safety net was being dismantled. Am I wrong?
No, that all happened. When you had this process just left to the market, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
without a government coming in and providing the structure, it just did not work. And it was admitted not to work very early, and that's when you had, I think... I might be fuzzy on some of the...
Wait, you're talking about Russia now? Or?
Yeah, Russia.
Yeah.
So then you had Jeffrey Sachs and those folks step in, and they really tried to create a so-called free market economy, but it was all by means of state imposition laws and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Russia, you sort of had this Wild West atmosphere in the immediate aftermath of the
right.
collapse, right, for the
right.
first maybe 5 years after the Soviet collapse.
Right.
And then they started to impose some order.
Right. The other example I like is of a free market is what happened in Iraq after the victory in Iraq.
Yeah.
And it was complete chaos and looting. And what was it? Rumsfeld said, well, this is what a free society is, where people
exactly.
can go ahead and loot.
Right. Essentially. That's pretty close to the verbatim anyway. Right. Freedom is chaotic, I think is what he said, right? Can you imagine? And then, of course, when Katrina happened, the same administration was calling for shooting looters on site. Life's little ironies. Okay, it's 3 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning. Same Bush administration, I should say. Isn't that what I said? It's 3 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning here on Listener Supported Non-Commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg. We're speaking with Andrew Kleiman, author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency. There's a few more questions I'd like to ask you, because up to this point we've sort of been critiquing the system and sort of looking at actually existing reality as opposed to looking at the future and where we as activists should be what we should be advocating, what we should be moving towards. So maybe we can briefly touch on that if we wanted to, maybe in about 10 minutes for the last 15 minutes of the show, we could consider taking some phone calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. But first, let me ask you the obvious question. For 1 week before election night, how do you view Barack Obama?
Well, I think Barack Obama is what we would have considered a moderate conservative back in the old days. Now, you know, that's pretty much a liberal. You know, in terms of some of his social outlook, he's more on the left. In terms of economic policy, he never said anything, of course, that had anything to do with this crisis until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
Neither he nor Clinton and McCain and none of them fundamentally addressed this. And when they began to talk about the economy, when the crisis was getting worse and worse in the spring and summer, they were just talking about, you know, infrastructure programs or capital gains tax cuts and various measures that were not dealing with the immediacy of the crisis. I don't think fundamentally that the government response to this crisis is going to be affected by, you know, whether Obama wins the election or perhaps McCain. They're going to do whatever they have to do to try to prop up the system.
All right. You don't think that McCain is more likely to put in place something which is going to be a much more of an emphasis on repression as opposed to rebuilding some kind of a social safety net? And that Obama might actually be at least somewhat looking back to FDR and helping out the little guy?
That might be true. When I say the crisis, I mean the immediate crisis of confidence, the so-called liquidity lock, the drying up of credit that is making the system really hang in the balance at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
What will then come is perhaps a very serious slump. We're in a recession. How long it lasts, how deep it goes, that's for anybody to say. And the government will do various things at that point. And there I agree with you. There is a likelihood that what will come down from an Obama administration would be different from a McCain administration. Of course, a lot depends in either case on people who are hurting, working people, people who have homes that they're being foreclosed on, having trouble making their mortgage payments. A lot depends on their own self-activity. Because what we saw coming out in the New Deal was government intervention, and it only seemed to take a progressive cast because of the self-mobilization of people who were fighting to protect themselves. And so they weren't fighting for government intervention. They were fighting for concessions from the government.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I do think that there will probably be a difference in the way that Obama and McCain would try to manage the slump. But in terms of, like, the immediate crisis, mm-hmm. bailing out Wall Street.
That would be fundamentally similar.
Yeah, the regulation. Mm-hmm. They have very limited options in a very acute crisis. There's just very little room to maneuver. They have to basically do what they're doing, responding to whatever emergency, trying to protect lenders so that people have confidence that if they lend, the loans yes. are going to be repaid.
All right. Now, at your talk last night, you invoked the possibility that if the system really does freeze up, if we really do have a big, serious economic crash, that there could really be a sort of a collapse into fascism. This was your word. Do you want to elaborate a bit on what that might look like?
Well, look, hell, anything could happen. If the system really were to collapse, if credit were really to totally freeze up, the economy just could not function for a very long period of time. I don't think that we're at that stage. I don't think that that's likely. But then anything could happen.
Mm-hmm.
When the economy does not function, you know, what would then happen? Well, whoever has the best organization and is able to get, you know, some people together and some weaponry could do basically whatever. I don't know what this would look like. It's not kind of a plan. It's what would happen in a moment of extreme, crisis and desperation. There are militias and all kinds of nuts in this country, and I don't know, what is like that. I mean, we've seen warlordism, return elsewhere in the world.
Very recently. Yes, indeed. Okay, so, you also invoked, on these airwaves tonight, the possibility of, quote, a movement to do away with the system. And you are a founding member of the Marxist Humanist Committee and a follower or a scholar of the works of Raya Dunayevskaya. So do you want to talk a little bit about what a movement to do away with the system might actually look like and what a potential transition to socialism, if this is something we could actually live to see?
Well, I think it's a possibility. I have to say that there has been a real problem on our side of people who talk about socialism of projecting it just as a beyond, just as a nirvana, and, oh, well, we don't have to think about what it would be, because we can't know, and the revolution will just change everything and free up people's minds and energies. That's basically a cop-out. So I think one of the positive things that came out in this decade was an attempt to theorize what an alternative to capitalism would be, fundamentally coming out of this decade. That work is really just beginning. So I can't give you a lot of specifics, and it's not a question of giving a blueprint in any
right.
case. It's a question of trying to understand how we can fundamentally operate in a modern kind of society by different means, not by self-interest, where we're fighting one another, you know, through these market rules and private ownership. Socialism is fundamentally, in the Marxian form, where you have a society where the free and full development of each individual is the guiding principle. What we're trying to talk about is to be able to free people so that they can develop. So Marx talked about this as human power or human development as an end in itself. It is its own end. Capitalism is fundamentally the opposite. That's the production of value as an end in itself. You know, you invest money to make more money, to make more money, to make more money, the self-expansion of value. So what would a movement look like? Well, it depends on whatever social forces are there at the moment and their immediate demands. That's what we have to fundamentally build on. The question then is, can these demands be satisfied within the system? If they can be, we're not going to move to a new society. But I think that you know, they largely cannot be satisfied within the existing framework. And what you need are people who have this understanding of how capitalism works, how it doesn't and can't be made to work for the immense majority, to explain why, in order to satisfy these demands, we have to move out of the existing framework. So we need the movement, we need the energy of people trying to better their lives, to organize themselves. Clearly, you're not going to have a small bunch of radicals organize a mass movement that can topple a system like capitalism. This has to come from below, from the people themselves. There have been historical experiences like this. Recently, we've seen stuff happening, for instance, in Argentina, but in our own country, the sit-down strikes of the 1930s in the Great Depression, that created a whole new union movement, the CIO.
Hmm. Although it didn't create a transition to socialism.
No, it did not create a transition to socialism. Hmm. And we could go into the reasons why not. And what is extremely important is not to try to make people believe that your organization or your little campaign is going to satisfy the demands. You know, for instance, people talk about a living wage campaign. Well, you're not going to get fundamentally living wages within capitalism. You know, for the great majority of people in the world, at least. There are people who try to organize on that basis because they believe that people are stupid and they believe that people are fundamentally apolitical and they don't want to hear about things like socialism. All they care about is bread on the table. So they want to hoodwink them essentially into thinking that, yeah, this campaign is going to satisfy your demands when they full well know it's not.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
So we need the energy from below of people bettering, trying to better their conditions, to develop themselves. We also need the recognition that, this system can't do it. We need people to be able to understand why that's the case, and we desperately need to talk and to think about, and this is not well worked out at all, what would a non-capitalist modern system be? How would it be able to function? We've never seen a modern economy that has run on a non-capitalist basis.
Mm.
And there are questions that still remain.
Well, that depends on what you mean by a modern economy, and certain people would take issue with that. But that's probably a whole separate conversation. Well, there's two people calling in. Should we consider taking a couple of phone calls? 212-209-2900 is the number. And I should say that one brief announcement, that there's going to be a press conference to protest the apparent NYPD sodomy of tattoo worker Michael Mineo this Thursday, October 30th at 3 p.m. on the steps of City Hall. So people who want to protest, be there. Remember, the steps of City Hall, you need to – they're not going to let you in if you're carrying a pocket knife, and I think you probably even need photo ID because we're no longer living in a in the open society of the good old days before 9/11. But once again, that's going to be a press conference to protest the police radio rape of tattoo worker Michael Mineo this Thursday, October 30th, 3 to 4 p.m. on the steps of City Hall. Let's take a couple of phone calls. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Turn down your radio. No. Hello, you're on the air. You're on the air. Third time's a charm. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I caught some of the program tonight. It's very interesting. And I was wondering, since it seems like the topic is basically like a change of, you know, a capitalist system. And I'm wondering if either of you have seen this video on the internet called Zeitgeist.com.
Oh, God. It looks pretty wacky. I don't know. Andrew, have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Mm. I took a look at the website at the urging of another listener, and it strikes me as pretty wacky, to tell you the truth.
Oh, even the what he presents at the end toward like a
I didn't watch the whole thing, but I poked around on their website.
It
looks pretty wacky. I mean, all this talk about, you know, the Jesus myth and so on, what does that have to do with the capitalist system and the world that we live in? I mean, it's interesting, but
it's kind of like he kind of showed how any system that keeps our mind or keeps people sort of stuck, you know, is a system that is going to eventually basically work against, say, growth and
yeah, well, it just struck me as being a kind of conspiratorial as opposed to actually having a critique of the system, which is an important distinction. Do you have a question for Andrew Kleiman, who is joining us this evening?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't. I just was hoping someone could comment about
this thing. All right, well, keep on listening. Let's see if we can get another call. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. Turn down the radio and speak up. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm moving a little bit faster. I thought it was a fascinating discussion. I was wondering whether the gentleman could talk about leverage and how I was listening to an investor person explaining what's happening with regard to the economy, and he said that they took something like $100 trillion worth of capital and have inflated it or leveraged it. Let me use the right word. Have leveraged it to $6 quadrillion.
Mm. Okay, so you want to know what that means and how that works?
Yeah. For instance, my understanding is in around 2001, they changed the ruling in which the investment banks could, rather than making $12 on $1, could then go up to as high as 32. And my understanding also is that in Europe, they went up to 50.
All right. Andrew, can you shed some light on this?
Yes, that's fundamentally correct. What leverage is borrowing. So in order to try to make profits with borrowed funds, you need some actual funds. You need some actual cash investments and so forth. But then you're allowed to borrow many multiple times over and buy assets, you know, speculate in the stock market, speculate in all kinds of derivatives and so forth. And that's what they did. So a leverage of 12 to 1 basically means you need capital or real assets of about 8% of what you eventually end up purchasing. And yes, in the early part of this decade, a few major Wall Street firms were allowed to increase their leverage, which means reduce the amount of actual capital they were holding, borrow more in order to finance their investments to somewhere in the range of over 30 to 1. So, 33 to 1 would be you have $3 of actual assets, and you're allowed to borrow 97 in order to make investments.
Mm. Okay. Well, I hope that sheds some light. Should we move on to another call? WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio. Speak up.
Yeah, I agree that we're heading towards a form of fascism. There's no doubt about that. But that's due to the collapse of social values, the old Judeo-Christian system that you failed to analyze to understand.
Okay. Andrew, any commentary?
Well, I have not said that we're moving to a form of fascism. I just said that it would be a distinct possibility if we were to have an actual collapse of the system due to, for instance, a total freezing of credit, which we haven't seen yet. I'm not a big believer in single cause explanations, so I would not want to say that everything is traceable to values. Where did the values come from? Why did they get created? Why do certain values survive rather than other values? That also needs to be explained, it seems to me.
Mm. I'll also point out that while I don't completely dismiss the analysis of the caller, that ironically, fascism is likely to come to this country, if it comes, in the form of shoving Christian values, so-called, down our throats. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Bill. Good morning. And I just want to commend your guest. Wonderful program tonight.
Thank you very much.
My thoughts are, and I'm surprised both of you didn't mention it, was the when you discussed the crisis in Latin America and in the former Soviet Union with regard to the debt, One of the resolutions was the Brady Plan that came out in the early 1990s. And the question I have really is, if there's going to be a fundamental change in the capitalist structure in terms of an alternate system, wouldn't there be a necessity to have an unwinding of the increased globalization that we are experiencing right now in the world economy? Because the Brady restructuring plan clearly created a situation where there was a duplicity between governments in the third world as well as the U.S. banking system by exchanging the assets, quote-unquote, of a lot of these third-world countries for the restructuring of that debt. And that creates havoc in monetary policies with inflation and various costs of labor and the creation of consumerist economies versus producing economies. And I just think that the old world kind of models that were used in Marxism, which were based on a producing economy, without the real view of the service economy as being a factor in the total economic GDP, should be considered. And I really do believe.
All right,
that.
So should we hear what Andrew has to say about this?
I would love to.
Okay, Andrew.
Okay, well, with regard to the point about Marxism and the producing economy versus the service economy, I'm not quite sure where the caller was going with that. There is some validity, I think, to that notion. However, that does not come from Marx himself. For Marx, you know, capitalist production does not care what it's producing, whether it's a tangible item or a so-called service, because what they care about is the self-expansion of value, production of value. And it doesn't matter, you know, what physical form it takes, if any. As to the issue about the unwinding of globalization, I'm not quite sure what you meant by globalization. Do you mean neoliberal policies imposed on the third world?
I would assume that's what he means.
Yeah.
Globalization of capital, corporate globalization, whatever, you know.
Right.
Everything we've been fighting for the past 15 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the end, look, the capitalist system has to work as follows. People who lend money, institutions who lend money, have to be assured that they're going to be repaid. Otherwise, the capitalist system cannot function. Okay. So once you tamper with that relationship, you are tampering with a fundamental pillar of the capitalist system. So, you know, when the third world countries cannot repay their debts, something has got to be done within the framework of the capitalist system. You can't just say, we're going to forgive the debt. Now, to some extent, there is debt forgiveness, but that's not really a matter of policy. That's mostly a matter of recognition of reality. When countries cannot pay their debts, you just have to write off their debts. Just like, you know, a company here would not be able to pay its debts. The banks just have to, who've lent to that company, just have to write that down.
All right. Shall we see if we can squeeze in one or two more calls? WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Speak up. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Am I on the air now?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Thank you. Here's the thing. You were talking about and I guess I was kind of, politely I would say this, nonplussed that leftist theory still hasn't evolved to the point where it can take in, you know, the 21st century as to what would supplant capitalism. But this is, I'll be very direct here. Considering human nature, if you will, you know, if you go back to the Greeks or whatever, you know, there are good impulses, there's greed, there are all of these things, you know, going around.
All right, but.
All right,
wrap it up.
Here's the thing. Isn't the best of both worlds what we have in Western Europe, capitalism / socialism, isn't that really about the best we can do as human creatures here?
Andrew.
Well, fundamentally, we don't know. There is human nature. But, you know, there's also things like poor eyesight. Inherited, and that's a part of human nature. Yet we have glasses and we can correct that. So can we correct the kind of world that we're living in? That's really the issue. Can we, without changing how human beings are, can we find ways of living that are more adequate to that? Now, I just fundamentally don't think that what takes place in Western Europe is as mixed or socialist or quasi-socialist as the caller does. I have a colleague in Sweden, a Marxist theorist who's written a major piece that I hope to be published soon on the Swedish economy, on the Swedish model, and he just fundamentally destroys this notion that this is some kind of a socialist system or was some kind of a socialist system. And the core of his analysis is, yes, there are people within the Swedish system who are protected by certain rights that we do not enjoy. But in order to protect those people, other people have to be systematically excluded from those rights to a greater degree.
Who are they?
Well, other people in Sweden, but also, I mean, if you look at all these Northern European countries.
Immigrants? You mean immigrants?
Yes.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.